This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Our guest is poet and essayist Sherry Parf. Sherry teaches writing and creative writing to sophomores and seniors in high school. A widely published writer, she's a founding member of the Chattanooga Writers Guild. One of her most recent essays, titled Exploration, won the Chattanooga Writers Guild's writing contest in June. Sherry will read that for us in a moment, but first, this is one of the poems she selected to share, titled Human or Otherwise.
To whatever creature moved the dead squirrel struck down by my car in that breathless moment between hesitation and memory, the empty bird feeders, the gnawed cactus, the stolen apples. Now a mere dark spot on the road that may be, after all, a hickory stain, the lifeblood of trees and not the tree climber. The memory and shock of the double thump already fading, I wish to say thank you and I'm sorry.
I love that. And, it's always a dangerous thing to generalize about somebody's work when you haven't only read part of it. But the impression I have of your work at this point is that the two things that seem to be a source of continuing inspiration for you is the natural world and traveling.
That's a fair thing to say, yes. Just today, I was sitting on my front porch watching birds across the road in the woods, and I just thought, I have to write something about these birds. And of course, then it ends up being something about people. You're right. Those are the kinds of things that inspire me to put something down.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in West Virginia, in southern West Virginia, little county, Wyoming County, with no large towns in it. The nearest town of any size is Beckley, West Virginia. And our claim to fame in the counties, the D'Antoni brothers, who some people will know as basketball coaches, are from Wyoming County. And then a football player, Kurt Warner, went to the same high school I went to. So yeah, I grew up in the hills and the hollers.
I've never been to West Virginia. The impression I had of West Virginia, to be honest, is that there's a great deal of poverty there and that it's very beautiful.
I'd say both of those things are true.
Yeah, and it's coal country, isn't it?
Yes. My dad was a coal miner. And coal, you know, at once enriched the people and then also devastated.
For your dad, that was his way of making a living,
right,
and supporting his family.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was when the union gained power, you know, they got really good benefits for the workers, and you know, I think it was in 1974 when the Mining Reclamation Act was passed. Before that, the companies would just do the most economical thing, come in and extract the coal, you know, the fastest, cheapest way possible.
When we were kids, they used to make us eat boiled eggs. I hate boiled eggs, but you know, you chop the top off it, you know, and that seems like that's what they do to the land, you know, just like you do to that egg.
Yeah.
And then all that's left in the end is the shell. Mm-hmm. Everything is just scooped out of it.
Yeah.
All the life is scooped out of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's not true of all the entire landscape, but that's true in a lot of areas. But there still is a lot of beauty there. It's still a lovely place to be. And, of course, right now the big thing to see, I think, is the New River Gorge Bridge. Remarkable work of engineering, and you know, it really highlights the countryside around it. So
have you written about your dad?
Some I did. I think I can't remember if this has actually been published in one of our Writers Guild anthologies. My dad's name was Dale McKinney, so I have a little essay called Dale McKinney's Daughter. My dad was a really funny man. Actually, he was a coal miner, but when I was young, I had a brain tumor and was disabled and unable to work after that. So he and I really bonded during his recuperation time. And in those days, I was a little girl, so, you know, it was the early 60s. Things were so almost primitive. I mean, it seems that way now to look back on it. But, yeah, he survived and lived quite a bit. You know, a lot more years until I was an adult. So, had some good years.
On Scenic Roots, this is Talking Writing. Our guest is Sherry Parf. We were talking about writing And that led to a conversation about a story that Sherry read during an interview that she taped with Mark Anderson from the Chattanooga Writers Guild about a year ago.
I had a writing friend say to me, she and I had gotten together to go over some stories, and I was working on a little story about picking up rocks on the beach, and I said, there isn't anything profound or unique about this story. And she said, but isn't that your job, to take an ordinary story and make something profound, you know, out of the experience? And yeah, I think that's it.
I do too.
At least that's part of it.
I do too. The story is not unique, it's the writer that's unique.
Yes.
Which brings to mind the story that you shared with Mark about your friend...
Arlene.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that moment we can all relate to. Some point early in our teenage years when all of a sudden we start seeing our world through other people's eyes.
Right. Yes.
What Mom knew. I can't wait to get to your house. My friend Arlene smiled as we ran across the playground. She was coming to spend the night with me, my first overnight visitor in sixth grade. But I was not as excited as she was. I was worried. Arlene was rich. Her dad owned a service station, and her house was on a hill surrounded by a pretty green lawn and rose bushes. I had spent the night there and admired it all. Her nice upstairs bedroom, the soft carpet in the hall, and the shiny bathroom at the bottom of the steps. I was not rich. My house was at the bottom of a hill between the woods and the creek. Our floors were covered with linoleum, and the bathroom was outside. We had a big bathtub inside to take baths in, but when we needed to go to the bathroom, we went outside to an old-fashioned outhouse. My mom always said it didn't matter. People don't come to see your house, she insisted. They come to see you. As long as you're nice to them, they won't mind. I wanted to believe her, but the outdoor toilet was a big worry. I knew that most of my school friends lived differently. They would only see a small, dark building that didn't smell nice. They wouldn't see what I saw, that sometimes it could be a place to get away or to enjoy a talk with my big sister. Late in the evening, when it was dark outside and neither of us wanted to go to the toilet alone, we went together. While my sister was inside, I stood beside the door, arms crossed, looking up at the stars and waiting my turn. Through the closed door, surrounded by quiet, we shared secrets and told stories that no one else could hear. Arlene, I thought, would not understand. Sure enough, when we jumped off the school bus and started down the dirt lane to my house, my friend looked about curiously. We deposited our books in the room I shared with my sister and ran out to play in the remaining daylight. Arlene hesitated when I showed her the outdoor toilet, but she didn't say anything. I could only imagine the stories she would tell at school the next day. We stayed outside riding bikes until almost dark. When we came back in to take baths and get ready for bed, Mom already had kettles of water heating. I explained that when each of us had things together for a bath, Mom would pour in the hot water and then enough cold water to make the bath comfortable. This was very different from the modern bathroom in Arlene's house. Now she'll really have something to talk about, I thought. Let me know when you're almost ready, honey, Mom called. Does your mom always talk to you this way? What way? Honey, does she always call you honey? I stopped and looked at my friend. Yes. Why? Arlene shrugged, and I thought of the evening I had spent at her house and how we'd had to sneak downstairs to the bathroom so that her parents wouldn't hear us and get angry. The next morning, we woke to the smell of fresh biscuits. Come on, girls, Mom urged. You need to eat breakfast before the bus gets here. I'm not used to eating this kind of breakfast, Arlene confided, as we sat down at the kitchen table and enjoyed eggs, pork chops, and biscuits. I remembered the shiny counters at her house, but I couldn't remember what we'd eaten there. After breakfast, we gathered our books and hurried to catch the bus. The ride to school usually seemed long, but on this day, it passed too quickly. Oh no, I thought as we got off the bus. Everyone will see that Arlene spent the night with me. I don't want to hear what she's going to say. I didn't have to wait long to find out. Filing into class with my fellow sixth graders, putting away books, and taking care of lunch, I heard Arlene's voice rising above the rest. "You all should go to Sherry's house," she announced. I braced myself. "Here it comes," I thought. But my friend's next words took me by surprise. "Everyone is so nice." Yes, I was surprised, but I shouldn't have been. It was what my mother had been trying to tell me.
Yeah, that happens to teenagers. I think it happens on and off all through our lives. We, moving to a new place or meeting someone for the first time, I think that happens. Sometimes we suddenly see.
The world in which you grew up, you took everything that Arlene thought was so wonderful as a given. That's just the way life is.
Right. Yes, that's absolutely right. Because I didn't have enough experience. Well, I had begun to have enough experience, but prior to spending the night at her house, I had just been with, my family. And that's the way life was. People were, and I now have grandchildren. And a couple of them are 3 years old, but I was talking about one of the three-year-olds the other day. She's absolutely fearless because everybody she knows loves her. She has no conception of a world where people don't just love her and wish the very best for her. And that's the way childhood should be. and I think that's the way my childhood was. I went to school. I did well in school. My parents thought I was wonderful. I had an older brother and sister who looked out for me. And then, of course, it's the right thing that one begins to branch out and find out that other people live in a little different way. But the good thing about my home was, that we were so, I felt completely protected and nurtured there. So that was a wonderful gift.
The essential irony in that story, which I thought was wonderful, it's almost like an O. Henry story, is that the little one who appeared to have everything didn't have, it's a cliche. She didn't have the one thing that really matters.
That's right.
So if you talk about, well, everybody knows this story. Yes, if you put it in those flat terms, they do, but not if you tell it the way you did, because then by not saying it, you say so much more.
Yeah, and the details, of course, the details, even though the truth is the same for a lot of people, the details are going to be different for different people.
And as you said, talking to Mark, and I could relate to that too, you like biographies and memoirs, I do too. And it's interesting to read other people's lives.
It surely is, yes. I just finished Joan Didion's book, The Year of Magical Thinking, and it concerns the year after her husband died and how she, have you read that book?
I read it
in 2 days. I just ate it up. And her life, very different from my life, but still there were things in it that I could latch on to and think about for myself. So probably most of us someday, at least half of us, will face the loss of a spouse. And, that's a life-changing thing. So, it was very interesting to read.
So, to get back to the thread, the reason I ask where you grew up is because I have the sense that one of the things that you find most disconcerting, and you're not alone in that, I don't think, in the modern world, is the disappearing wild.
Yes.
Because you grew up in at least a semblance of wildness, didn't you?
I did, yes. My house sat on, out my back door was the woods, and I spent a lot of time in the woods. And yes, I think it's so important. Even now, I love being outside. I feel I can think more clearly outside. I feel that natural light is so much so much better for me than artificial light. I love being outside, and I think there are a lot of health benefits that have been documented that it's really healthy physically to be outside. But I think, you know, I really need some, I feel like my mental health needs to be outside. And I'm afraid that not only are people just not going outside for, you know, vacation or something, but I just think on a daily basis, people just stay inside far too much and just miss things like where the sun rises and what birds are outside their house. And, you know, those just ordinary things, what the sky looks like at certain times of day. It does bother me that those are the kinds of things that people are going to, you know, to their detriment, miss out on.
Yeah, we were lamenting our mediated world. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I think maybe that is the greatest loss of this increasingly mediated world.
Mm-hmm.
They're missing the immediate, right, that which you cannot control.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control the sound. You can't control the contrast. It is what it is.
That's
the sun's going to get in your eyes, and wind's going to blow your hair.
Yeah. They're a very climate-controlled environment, and I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're right.
On Scenic Roots Talking Writing, our guest is poet and essayist Sherry Poff. This is a poem she was moved to write after the loss of a neighbor.
Yeah. Okay, this is called Missing. My neighbor's roses are blooming, the best I've seen in years. The pink one by the mailbox I stop and admire on evening walks. The one her son gave her for Mother's Day, flourishing in gentle shade. One near my fence, the one we rescued when a careless nephew backed his car over it. We worked together, kneeling in soggy ground, gently reshaping twisted stems, tying it up with shoestring and twine. The roses are blooming, bright spots in troubled times, but Betty will not see them. Today, her son has arrived with two friends who muscle their way into the house, emerge with a china cabinet, a washing machine, a mattress. Beneath thick gray clouds, they work, hurrying ahead of the rain. A cool, pale shower chills the air, misting the roses. And next week we will gather, sister, son, a few old neighbors, clustered around the open ground, our thoughts bound up with tears, stories, and laughter. Perched on padded chairs, our restless feet in the cool green shade, we'll sing Amazing Grace and say goodbye to Betty, thinking how much she would love the spray of roses atop her coffin.
I love that. Phrase comes to mind, in the midst of life, because that's exactly what you capture there. Mm-hmm. There's so much life in your poem. And it isn't, in that sense, I suppose, that's exactly how it happens. At the end, that's it.
Yes.
You know, and until the end, it's not clear. The bed is not there.
Okay, I'm glad. This is primarily a true story. I can just picture it as I remember sitting on my front porch, as I do so much, and, just observing what was going on. And I remember seeing, actually, it's her private life, so I don't want to be too, give too much of her story, but she was not home, and I was afraid she was going to miss seeing her roses. And so I said to her son, she had been sick for some time, I saw him, and I said, has she seen these roses? And he said, I'm going to bring her over here and let her see them. So I hope that happened, because they were just stunning. Last year, 2020, was such a strange time. As a teacher, I spent my days at home teaching online, so I was around my house a lot more than I normally am in the spring. Saw a lot more things, going on and got to spend more time in my yard. But nobody could come. So I began taking pictures of what was blooming in my yard and sending them to my children. And we've kept that up. We still do that. Every now and then somebody will take a picture now blooming in my yard, you know, and send it.
Well, I think that's a very nice thing to do. I take your point, though. It was a curious kind of virtual existence that we had for so long, wasn't it? While it was going on, I think for most of us was rather disconcerting. At the same time, I think it sent us a very clear message. What we need to value, what matters, you know. And you're sharing things that it's important to share those because that bloom isn't going to last very long.
That's right.
So you capture that moment.
There's that, who wrote the poem? Was it Robert Herrick? Gather you rosebuds while you may. Old time is still a-flying. I think it was in the Joan Didion book I was reading. She talked about reading, and I believe it's an Emily Post book about the etiquette of death and what one should do. And, you know, I thought it was kind of amusing. She said, first you draw the blinds in the room where the individual has died, and then you tell a servant to draw all the other blinds. And I thought, tell a servant? Who has servants? But this was in the 20s, Emily Post. But anyway, but the thing that that the author, Joan Didion, the author, said was, in the 20s, it was just a fact. You know, they were just out of the 1918 pandemic. Everybody knew somebody who had died. And everybody understood that there are things that need to be done. And, you know, she said even in 2000, I think this book I just read came out in 2005, even then, she said those basic things were still true. You know, a way of responding. And that's what, in this poem, you know, that the children come and clean out the house. That's mm-hmm. what they do. These are things that need to be done. And it's some people, that's the way they deal with grief, I think.
Yeah.
They
mm-hmm.
And other people want to just sit with
that's
it
right.
a little
that's
bit.
That's right. I remember one time, I probably read it, where somebody asked Dylan, how do you remember all those lyrics? And he said, well, I think in pictures. Mm-hmm. Do you think in pictures? You were talking before about how, you know, and again, that's been said many times, you know, that what you hear in your head or what you see in your head is what you want to say is very difficult to get a handle on it and
sometimes
put it on the page. There's something about the transmutation between your head, your hand, and the page when things change.
Right, right. And it seems sometimes we just can't quite find the right words to transmit that feeling.
Mm.
So two things come to mind. One, Wendell Berry, wonderful writer, said, he was talking about writing a poem, don't try to make some meaning, just describe what you see. And then, you know, often some meaning will emerge. And Anne Lamott has a book called Bird by Bird. And she says to give yourself tiny little, she calls them postage stamp assignments. And she said, if you think of the whole thing you want to say, it becomes paralyzing. So just describe getting out of the car and walking to the door. And then once you've described that, you describe the next thing and the next thing. And so sometimes that's what I have to revert to when I have what I see as a big idea. I just have to take it, you know, bird by bird, piece by piece. And I think oftentimes I do think in pictures. I really love Annie Dillard as well. And she talked about when she was a little girl, she fancied she was a detective. And she had learned to draw. And so she would go out into the neighborhood and see people she thought were suspicious. And then she would memorize their features by saying, you know, he has blonde hair. he has bushy eyebrows. His nose is wide. You know, she would say the words, and then she could go back home and reproduce the face by saying the words. Everybody has a different method, but somehow or other, we have to have an image.
Well, you know, it's funny, because when you said, okay, so I'll describe getting out of the car and walking into the house. Mm-hmm. And it's true. Two people describing that event would describe it quite differently.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that's
and true. And accurately, because two people would do that quite differently, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. What you see while you're walking, the way you walk, the way you get out of the car, the way you close the door, all of those things that are just sort of things you don't even think about. It goes back to what you were saying before about memoirs, you know. We are individuals, so even though it may seem commonplace to us, to somebody else, oh, that's interesting, so that's how you do it.
Right. Yeah.
Poet and essayist Sherry Poff with her own Richard Wenham. Listen to the rest of their talking writing conversation next Wednesday here on Scenic Roots on WUTC.